Hi, this is Terry Stewart, CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. And you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on one of my favorite shows, the Harmony Street Show.
Hey, Mike, John Mathis.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. It's Johnny Mathis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my pleasure to have as my guest, DJ, trendsetter, renaissance man, music agent, manager, and all-around good guy, my friend, Mr. Alan White. How you doing, Alan?
I'm doing great after that introduction. That was great. I didn't know I did all those things.
Well, you know, we'll see as we go. Now, you were born in Bridgeport, Connecticut, right?
I was, during the war, 41. I lived in Stratford, which is a Bridgeport suburb.
Right.
So I was like about, five or six. We moved up to Torrington, Connecticut. My father had a job up there. And I lived there till I was, 8 or 9. Then my dad got divorced, and I was in military school and private school until I was like 15.
Right.
Well, and then back to Torrington, and I... I had a teenage nightclub in my basement.
Torrington was a great town. I mean, you know, when I had Harmony Street, we did the Warner Theater a lot. It was a great town, and the theater had, a lot of great history. So just being there was great.
Somebody in some magazine printed that Torrington was the best city in America to grow up in.
Wow.
I wouldn't argue with that. It was about 30,000 people. It was a manufacturing town, full employment. The Warner Theater was great. There were two other theaters, the Palace and the State.
Wow.
And it was a pretty good town to grow up in. I wouldn't argue with that.
So you're admitting that you're all grown up, huh?
Well, no, I was really referring to the rest of the people that lived there.
Oh, okay.
I actually left and got a job in a rock and roll band.
Well, let me ask you this. When you were a kid, what kind of music did you listen to? What did you gravitate to?
Well, you know, I mean, I listened to the radio like everybody else.
Right.
So as a kid, I listened to top whatever they played in the radio, Rosemary Clooney and that kind of thing. I remember I was in boarding school, and we heard Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel, and I stopped my roommate. I said, "Listen to this." And he wasn't a very musical guy. He wanted to be a sportscaster, but he didn't care much about music.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Why? What is with this?" I said, "I don't know what that is, but this is going to change the way they make records forever."
Wow.
And it was because of the reverb.
Oh,
If you listen to Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just a lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be just a lonely baby. I'll be just a lonely. It's so lonely, they could die. Now the bellhop's tears keep flowing, and the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on Lonely Street, they'll never, never look back and think of so. They think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely. Well, they're so lonely, and they could die.
Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down Lonely Street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. Well, you think you're so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
So lonely they could die.
There has never been, up until that time, a record that sounded anything like it.
Right.
okay. I don't have to have it. Okay.
Just hold it up. That's good.
Oh. Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh. Oh. I got some. I'm all shook up. Oh. Oh. Everybody's entitled to one stupid ass mistake. You should have one in there, man. You should have one in there that you can use.
It was a total just change in music.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, we all got into rock and roll. When I got out of boarding school, I guess I was 15, and I lived at home briefly.
Right.
We had a teenage nightclub in the basement.
Yeah, tell me about that, because it sounds like...
My drums up on a riser.
Right.
And I had a record player right next to it. And I play records, play drums along with the records.
Right.
We had red cellophane over all the lights. So
right.
It was all red in there. We had a couple of couches and a bookcase turned around to make
uh-huh.
a bar.
We
sold Kool-Aid and cigarettes that,
wow.
you know, that nobody knew we were selling. We had a 10-cent cover charge. It was called the Bop Shop.
Right.
And I had a partner, and then we had a bouncer, my buddy Frank.
Wow.
Big old kid.
So you weren't just kidding, you know, you actually had an operation going and you had kids coming in and enjoying the festivities. It just wasn't you standing in the corner pretending you were doing it.
Yeah, you could put the sign up. We had a sign on a tree that said open or closed. And you put eye hooks. And you could put the eye hook sign open on it.
Wow.
You had 15 or 20 kids within 15 or 20 minutes.
Wow.
It was pretty cool. We had that for a year, year and a half, made some
wow.
money, had some fun.
Wow.
And it kind of, I guess I got known as a guy that could DJ a
wow.
little bit. And they called me to do some record hops. I did some record hops. My father used to bring home his dictaphone. He was an accountant.
Right.
And he'd bring home his dictaphone, and I practiced being a DJ on those dictaphone tapes.
Wow.
And then I got sidetracked about, well, 1960 or so.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I had an offer to join a particular rock and roll band, or actually be a drummer to back up this amazing front guy.
Right.
And I took that. I did that for about 3 years.
Did you record anything with these guys?
I did not. He didn't really want to record. He
uh-huh.
was a country boy.
Right.
Didn't like cities much.
Right.
He made one record before I joined him.
Right.
It wasn't a great experience for him.
Right.
And he just liked playing live in the clubs, and you know. I mean, if I'm being honest, it was about chasing girls and drinking beer.
Hey,
I mean,
which helps too. What kind of drums?
We're turning the party cats for a reason. Everybody drank a lot in those days. We drank throughout the 60s, the 70s, I think probably into the mid 80s. It explains a lot of the behavior, I think, of that whole generation.
What kind of drums did you have?
You know, I never did any drugs.
No. What kind of drums? What kind of drums did you
have? I said drugs.
No, we're going to do it again. What kind of drums did you have?
What kind of drugs?
What kind of drums? Well, we get to the drugs later. What kind of drums did you have?
For drums, I started out with just a secondhand set. I don't even remember what they were. I wound up with a Ludwig silver chrome snare and a bunch of Japanese drums called Crown. They didn't sound great, but
uh-huh.
I had great Dilgen cymbals and a great snare,
uh-huh.
and we got the kick drum so it sounded good by putting a comforter inside it,
uh-huh.
and it muted it real well,
uh-huh.
and it just looked good, and the snare and the cymbal, I mean, played good. I also was in the union, so I got called for jazz dates, just because I was in the union, they would call me, and I would get there, and they'd be like, you read? I'd be, no. Sinatra dates, that kind of thing. I enjoyed doing them. That was a second interest of mine until jazz got completely crazy and lost the groove.
Yeah.
I actually dug jazz more than I did rock and roll.
Huh?
Rock and roll was kind of boring. It was the same thing over and over, but it was loud and it was fun and we drank a lot. You know, like the Beatles said, it was a good way to meet girls.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Moving through the 60s, you were on the radio at one point.
I was in a band called Thunderbirds and...
Uh-huh.
1963. It was a four-season sound-alike band, an
uh-huh.
excellent band. The,
wow.
the kid, that Tommy, that fronted it was almost as good as Frankie.
You got to be good,
and
really,
they,
to do that.
They were great. And we were just working weekends, and I was bored during the week, so I took a job at a hospital up Poughkeepsie just during the day running the stock room.
Uh-huh.
And I was listening to the radio one day to a kid named Bard Sarge, who was just terrific.
Right.
And he read an announcement from the wires of the Associated Press that the president had been shot in Dallas.
Wow.
And we had no television down there, and so obviously I was glued to the radio. And I didn't know this until later, but he was alone at the station. So he played a record. He ran through the newsroom, the news booth, into the newsroom to the very, very back,
wow,
grabbed another bulletin from the Associated Press teletype, ran back, repeated the first one, and then read the second one. He kept doing that,
wow,
because he was alone. Eventually, the news director came in, Jim Terrell, a great news director out of WBZ in Boston. He couldn't stay at major stations because he had a big drinking problem. We were lucky to have him.
Right.
And he was sober that day, and listening to that coverage on the radio, I called my father over the weekend, and I said, you know what? You always offered to send me to DJ school. I'm going to take you up on it.
Right.
And it just inspired me. And very soon thereafter, really, that was November 22nd. By February, I was in the Columbia School of Broadcasting in D.C.
Wow. And, great school. Yep.
It was a great school.
Yep.
I had one of my teachers was a guy named Dean Griffith, who was, that was a stock station name at WPGC.
Right.
Great top 40 DJ. He went on to become Dean Anthony, the all night guy at WPGC.
I remember him, sure.
For years and years. And he was great. He would invite me to his remote broadcasts, and he would hand me the microphone and get me to read all the commercials. It was great. He was a terrific guy. I learned a lot. It was a great school.
Music Radio 77.
Everybody knows it's windy, and everybody knows that's the big one in Radio 1, the Association of Numero Uno, and it's a good song. It's 9 past 1, Dean Anthony here throughout the night. 71 degrees right now in Midtown. Humidity is pretty much up there at 90%. And the man says cloudy with a chance of a couple of showers overnight with a low near 70. It'll be sunny and hot today with a high up anywhere between 85 and 90.
And when I got out, I sent out tapes. I wasn't very good. I wasn't very bad.
Right.
But I wasn't great. Nobody was going to jump out of their skin.
Uh-huh.
And nobody really responded, so I went to WHBW, the station I'd been listening to in Poughkeepsie,
right,
where Sarge was, and I applied there, and I got a job doing news in the morning and production in the afternoon and some sales. I wound up doing weekends, and next thing you know, I was following Sarge.
Wow.
So I went to work at the same station. He and I are great friends. He became Johnny Donovan. He's been at WABC for over 40 years.
I remember Johnny Donovan.
The most music on WABC New York.
Johnny Donovan.
Yeah, baby. Look what you've done for me there. That's Al Green on 77.
Donovan, WBZ Radio, ABC.
And if you were away for the weekend, we'll drive home together tonight. Hope everything is going all right for you. Just take it easy. But don't go to sleep. It's Eagles. Take it easy. You got plenty of time.
Radio WABC.
With the Eagles, it's 6 minutes after 7 o'clock. Johnny Donovan behind the microphone here. And roll those records. That's what we used to say in the old days. Too late to turn back now. Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose.
You know, Poughkeepsie, very interestingly, I spent many years in Danbury, Connecticut, and when I had Harmony Street, we used to do the Poughkeepsie Oldie Station all the time. It was Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz on the Solid Gold Jukebox, and we were regulars there, and they played our stuff regularly. And I just spoke to Rick today, but of course, as stations change, you know, they change the format. And Rick, after being in Poughkeepsie for probably 25, 28 years, those guys, you know, they just had to pack it in, you know, which is tough. So people that get their oldies and their doo-wop and their R&B where they can. You know.
Well, when I was there in 1965, and I was only 24.
Right.
And you got to have in radio, in anything in life, you have to have a place to be bad.
Right.
That's one of the problems with live music in America. There aren't any clubs left for bands to go, you know, kind of small clubs where they can go be bad for a while.
You're right.
And because of Sarge, we owned that town. So I wound up doing an afternoon drive at a number one station. Our competitor was WABC.
Wow.
In fact, we were a daytimer. So when we signed off, we would tell everybody, okay, well, that's it for Russ. We'll see you tomorrow morning for the Dick Negan Show. Everybody, turn your radio now to 1620 WKBW Buffalo. Joey, say hello to everybody. And Joey Reynolds would welcome all the listeners from HB and Poughkeepsie.
Wow.
He wanted the listeners, and we wanted our people to stay away from WABC. We didn't want them turning on 77, wake up in the morning with 77, and not come back to us.
Well, I'll blow your mind. Tommy Shannon, also from WKBW.
I thought he was all nice. I thought Tommy Shannon was the smoothest guy ever.
Yep.
Joey Reynolds was the greatest disc jockey I ever heard for nighttime radio. He buried guys like Brucey. Joey was the best. He was crazy, but he was the best.
Yep.
But Shannon, man, Tommy Shannon was just Mr. Smooth.
I know.
Tommy Shannon Show, baby radio. Tommy Shannon Show.
Thank you, Jim Taylor, and hi to you, everybody, aboard the Shannon Show. From now until 9 o'clock this evening, we'll get things underway with Curtis Lee. Pretty Little Angel Eyes, that should do the trick. Arizona's real hot, man.
Pretty Little Angel Eyes.
WKBW Radio's Good Times, 79. KB Grease in Buffalo, the Tom Shannon Show, till 9. Sultry is our weather word. Stand by.
And he was great. So was the whole station was great, but you didn't hear them. They were 50,000 watts at night, but during the day they were only 10,000 watts, and you couldn't hear them. You couldn't hear Danny Never at the afternoon guy outside of Buffalo.
Well, you know, there was a station in Waterbury, Connecticut, WWCO, and one of the DJs there was Johnny B. John Bunnell, who actually stayed in Waterbury all those years. But Joe McCoy came from that station. Bob Sagendorf from ESPN came from that station. Chris Berman, the sports guy, came from that station. It was just like a proving grounds, and you know. Nobody knew why. The planets were lined up. I guess they had good energy. But most of the jocks from that station went on to good places.
Well, those were the towns where you started. Waterbury, New Haven. Dan Ingram came from New Haven.
Yeah. What a great guy. Dan Ingram was
the
funniest guy in the world.
There ever was.
Yep.
Ingram is the gold standard for a top 40 DJ.
Yep.
And he came from there, and Poughkeepsie was another proving ground. Kingston, New York, Atlantic City, those kind of markets.
Wow.
Waterbury. You could go, and as I said, you could not be bad. Maybe that's the wrong phrase, but you could learn your craft. And by the time Sarge got to New York, I mean, he was killing it.
Wow.
I only did a year, and I got bored. And I told my father, I said, you know, for me, radio was just kind of boring. You're in a booth all by yourself. A lot of times you're the only person in the station.
You're right.
And I said, in an ideal situation, I could be a DJ, because I like being a DJ better than I do playing the drums.
Right.
I could be a DJ in clubs. So he laughed. And maybe, I don't know how long went by, and I got a call, a true story, from a gal I knew at Vassar College, which is located in Poughkeepsie. And she wanted me to come over and DJ a discotheque dance.
Right.
And I said I'd be delighted to do it if you would tell me what a discotheque is. and she said, well, and she you know, babied me along. She said it's a French word.
Right.
And it means a nightclub where they play records instead of a band. And I said, wow. And I said, well, and she said it's huge in Europe.
Right.
And I said, wow. And I said, I don't have that music. No, she said, we don't worry about it. We have the music. Just, you know, bring over the equipment and DJ it for So I did, and that became, oddly enough, coincidentally, the first dance in America that anybody knows of under the name discotheque.
Wow.
So you skip ahead, like, I don't know how long it was, and I left the station, and a buddy of mine and I bought a nightclub real close to the Connecticut border where the drinking age was 21.
I grew up in Armonk, and we had the same thing. Everybody
right.
And that's why Armonk had about 32 bars in the town, because it was all borderline Connecticut, right?
Everybody went across the line, particularly on weekends.
You bet.
So I told my partner, I said, you know, we don't need, at the standard back in those days was two bands. So when one band was on a break, the other band would play.
Right.
I said, we don't need two bands. Get me some stuff from the station. He was the sales manager at HB.
Right.
I said, get me some old equipment from the station. We'll build a little DJ thing. I'll DJ before the band starts. I'll DJ their breaks, and I'll DJ after they go home.
Right.
And we won't have to have two bands. So that's what we did, and we added the name Discotheque to the sign. So it became the Rumpus Room Nightclub and Discotheque.
Wow.
And little did we know, it was the first disco in America.
Wow, that's amazing. So I read somewhere that you were spinning tunes at a Mr. Softy for a dollar a kid. So
yeah, that took it up
a notch.
I was just went in to get an ice cream one day, and a guy said to me, you're Alan White from the radio station. And I said, I am. And he said, I want you to come play tunes in my back room here, Mr. Softy, Friday and Saturday night.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And I said, how much? And he said, well, I can't pay you anything. And I said, well, that's not good. He said, but he said, you could charge a dollar, and we'll charge a dollar, and you could have the dollar. So I got a buddy of mine, Lance Michaels, who I was just back in touch with a few years ago, the state engineer, and he'd bring the equipment up for $10, set it all up. And I think we had 160 kids the first night.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's three times what I was making at the radio station. And I said, man, I'm in the wrong business here. We started promoting shows. Sarge and I started doing shows at the Juliet Theater, which was so close to Vassar, it was considered on campus.
Right.
The theater. We had the Crystals and Chiffons and later the Shangri-Las, and we made a ton of money doing that. We had a great time.
Well, I'll bet, sure.
And Sarge, he's the greatest guy. Anyhow, so we opened the club. We did the discotheque. I did that for about a year. And then my partner was running it. I got bored with it. I took off. I did some promotions down in North Carolina. And a guy called me, and I'd been doing some booking with various artists that I knew. I knew Ronnie Dove from broadcasting school.
Right.
I met the Shangri-Las at the radio station, and I was booking a few people who were. And he said, look, I need an agent for my agency, my booking agency in Washington, D.C. And I'd been to broadcast school in Washington. I liked it. And he offered me a job, and I took it.
Hmm.
And the job was to book the great touring bands. Now, we didn't own them all, but he had five or six of the great ones. The great touring bands of the 1960s. And I know you remember these bands. These bands were great cover bands.
Right.
You know, you got to be a lot more talented to be in a cover band than you do in an original.
You bet, because you got to do it all. That's why Long Island in the old days, you know, had all the great cover bands and clubs on every corner. And to do this stuff and do top 40, you had to learn three tunes a week. So you had to stay fresh. It was great.
In New York, it was the Peppermint Lounge, Joey G,
right.
And the Wagon Wheels right next door.
Right.
Every city had them. In Baltimore, it was Sweeney's and the Club Venus. And
right.
You know, every city had these kind of clubs.
Knew
and
them all.
Booking these bands. And I really loved it. Washington, D.C. had great clubs. The Crazy Horse and the Rocket Room and Benny's Rebel Room and Rand's and the Hayloft and the Keg and the Rabbit's Foot, and these were all clubs that used those kind of bands, and it was fun for a couple of years.
Right.
About a year, I guess. And then I met Len Barry.
Right.
I booked him into a hotel.
I love Lenny, you know.
Yeah, he's great. We didn't get along when we first met. The first night we met, he was like, well, this guy's really arrogant. But what do you bet he invites me out to, you know, after the gig, to go to some club where he'll pick up my tab and make me sing 1, 2, 3.
Right.
And I thought, boy, this guy's really arrogant. I'm going to drag his ass out of here and take him down to Rocket Room, make him sing 1, 2, 3.
Uh-huh.
The Bomstein Brothers will love me.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we did.
All right.
So he went down there. We all drank a lot. I picked up the tab. He sang 1, 2, 3. Sanford Bomstein was over the moon. Everybody was happy.
Right.
And he went home. He went back to Philly. Like 6 weeks later, the phone rings. At my office, I answered, Paramount Artists. And he says, how come you're not booking me? I said, well, I'll tell you what. If you'll tell me who this is, I'll tell you why I'm not booking you. He said, it's Len Barry, man, in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
Hi, this is Len Barry, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on his Harmony Street show.
I said, well, here's why I'm not booking you. I'm not your agent. You might want to call your agent.
Right.
I got you from Larry Maggot up at GAC.
Uh-huh.
No, he said, I went to high school with Larry Maggot. Let me explain something to you. He says, if your record drops off the charts, and his had dropped off the chart, this was 1966.
Right.
And he had his three solo hits. He said, they lose your number at GAC.
Right.
And he said, well, he booked me. And I said, well, I'd be delighted to do it. The guy that runs this agency owns this agency, doesn't like me booking people that we don't have signed.
Uh-huh.
Get me some dates, he said. Oh, sorry.
Right.
So I got on the phones and I booked him like 30 dates.
Wow.
All up and down the East Coast. So I didn't know the guy, so I went on the road with him.
Right. Okay.
To make sure he showed up, right?
Right.
And these were all Baltimore, Washington, Philly, Richmond kind of dates, North Carolina kind of thing,
right.
All close. And so I would roll with him. And he signed. And then I got a call from, I think it was Dee Dee Sharp was next. And she heard about this. And Premier Talent wasn't booking her enough, so I started booking Dee Dee. And then Jimmy Jones, the great gentleman I ever met.
Right.
And Bobby Lewis and the Kalin Twins. And all of a sudden, here we are, this little agency in Washington, D.C. that's supposed to be booking bands.
Uh-huh.
And we're booking record acts, driving Frank Barcelona, premier talent in New York, absolutely crazy. I'm stealing his act. And then I get a call from Larry Magid. Larry Martiri.
Okay.
He's the manager of the Shangri-Las.
Right.
Alan, he said, I hear you're booking everybody down there in Washington. I said, I am. I'm doing a good job. How are the girls doing? Well, he said, Premier's booking them, but they're not getting very many dates. So I said, I repeated my, you know, you got to sign with us story. Well, he said, see what you could do, and we'll sign with you. So it was almost a coincidence, but I had a buyer friend of mine out in Kansas, a guy named Jim Reardon, and he bought the Shangri-Las, who you could buy on the East Coast for probably $500 to $750 a night.
Right.
He bought them for $1,000 a night for 30 consecutive days, and he promised me they would never leave the state of Kansas.
Uh-huh.
Now, he was reselling them. And some dates he would sell and he gets $1,500 for them to make a profit.
Right.
Some dates during the week he gets $750, he'd lose money. But at the end, he came out with a profit. So I called Larry and I said, I got 30 days for you in Kansas, $30,000. What do you want to do? Well, he was over the moon. He couldn't believe that. And I get a call from Mary from the Shangri-La. She was mad because she said, there's no TV in Kansas. I said, you're probably right.
Wow.
But they did the tour. It was amazing.
Oh, that's so fabulous.
Then Larry wanted to sign them. He flew in.
Right.
Like, okay, yeah, right. So my boss took him out to dinner, and we signed the Shangri-Las. Next thing you know, I'm booking them.
Cool. So
for a couple of years, we really had a very hot agency.
Tell me about the Kalin twins. How were they to work with?
They were great. They had one hit. It was huge.
I remember.
And they got as far as Ed Sullivan. They were on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
They were really nice kids. They were Canadian. Hal and Herbie.
Right.
And they really were so, they looked so much alike. As well as I knew them, I had trouble telling them apart.
Right, right. Well, I remember the When tune, you know, because that was basically on every AM station, you know, that played pop. They were great.
I don't want to ever say goodnight. I need you. I want you near me. I love you. Yes, I do, and I hope you hear me when I say, be mine. If you will, I know all will be fine. When will you be mine? When you kiss me back, I don't want to ever say goodnight. I need you. I want you near me. I love you. Yes, I do, and I hope you hear me when I say, be mine. If you will, I know all will be fine. When will you be mine?
When will you be mine?
But also the Kalin twins were like so on the other side of the spectrum from the R&B stuff. Because, you know, when I was listening to the radio when I was younger, for some reason, I liked all the pop stuff that was on ABC. But my ear also went to the end of the dial, and I was listening to the harp tones and the nutmegs and the spaniels and that kind of thing. So I was kind of caught in the middle of, you know, the Kalin twins and then sneaking over and listening to WBLS and those stations to catch the harmony groups. It was interesting.
I think we all did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Baltimore, I listened to WCAO for pop, but I listened to WIPH, the R&B station, Long Lean, like
right.
Larry Dean, and got cats like that that played the R&B. I think we all did that. Eventually, it all came together.
I got, we did a lot of work with Bobby Lewis over the years, and very interesting, you know, when he got a little bit older, we were on stage with him one time when I was with the Mystics, and we're doing a big oldie show. And, you know, he used to like to tell jokes on stage. But, you know, of course, you know, Bobby's vision wasn't that good and it was getting worse and worse and worse. So
Ronnie Dove told me that, yeah.
He got, yeah, he was, you know, just about blind by now, but he got turned around and he's telling a joke to who he thinks is 2,000 people sitting in the audience. But the audience is looking at his behind and he's telling it to the sax player. And people are roaring and he's saying, I don't know what's going on. I never got this kind of a response from that joke before, whatever, whatever, whatever. And they let him finish the joke. And then two guys came out and turned them around and said, Bobby, you're telling the joke to the sax player, you know, and turned them back towards the front of the stage because he couldn't see. But that was even funnier than the joke.
It was yeah, that is funny. Bobby's a great guy. I just friended him on Facebook, but I sent him a message, but he hasn't answered me. I'm not sure he can see.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes they have people doing their Facebook for them, and, you know, it's not, they don't catch all the little crumbs, you know, or recognize people they know. You know, it's funny about Facebook, just for a second. I want to say that there are those who run their own Facebook pages, like a Jimmy Clanton. And if he likes something that you write or something catches his interest, he'll sit there and he'll talk back and forth with his fans. There are others, not to mention them, who couldn't care less. They like to put something on there and then see how many thousands of people, like, respond to it. And they sit back and they go, tee-hee, aren't I great? And they don't bother to respond back. And those I find to be the two. Well, probably right. So... You're probably right about that.
He does that all the time.
No, I understand. But, you know, in defense of Dion, you know, at the beginning he used to answer and go back and forth. But, you know.
Shoo-bop, shoo-bop, whoa, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, whoa, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, whoa, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, whoa, shoo-bop.
I can forget the first time I saw you walking by. My heart stopped for the moment. There was I had to find a way to make you look my way. There was joy in my heart. I couldn't turn away. One more girl, can I say?
Yeah.
shoo-bop, wow, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, wow, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, wow, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, wow, shoo-bop.
I can't forget
wow, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, wow, shoo-bop.
I saw you walk
wow, shoo-bop, shoo-bop, wow.
He's, you know, he lives down the block from me, and, you know, every day is different with him. You know, you never know what you're going to get.
To me, that's the great American music story. That's the one movie they haven't made.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. Well, you know, Kenny Vance wanted to get involved with that at one time, you know, the Dion story, The Wanderer, they were going to call it, of course, and it never came to fruition. Somebody should do it. I think it's still ripe to be done because his story is a great story.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. I mean, at one point he got involved with drugs and heroin. He went up, he went down, he
yep.
went sideways. He's always been, you know, if you look at Dion's career, first with the Belmonts, then he had an amazing solo career, and then he bounced back with Abraham Martin and John.
Well, and the Del Satins. Let's not leave them out, you know.
Right. Well, the Del Satins, basically when the Belmonts went away, the Del Satins took their place and just weren't credited.
But never got credited. Well, hey, listen, right. Stan and Freddie and Les and Tommy were all good friends of mine and have been for years, and they are the unsung heroes, man. They're on more records than a lot of groups that had big hits. And they don't get the credit.
Hi, this is Stan Zizka, original lead singer of the Del Satins. And you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show. And I'd like to thank you, Mike, for making me the first interview on your show.
But you know, they wound up okay, too. That was a deal that I pulled off one of them left the group. But three of the Del Satins became the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, we'll talk about that. I want to get to that, and I want to talk about that at length.
That was funny.
One of the things, I understand that you had some dealings with Casnets and Katz, and I used to be up at their office on Northern Boulevard in Great Neck a bunch of times because when they had some of these groups, Crazy Elephant and some of these where the group was defunct, they used to call me up and say, get a group together fast. You want to be the Crazy Elephant this week? You want to be the 1910 this week?
Right. They had no band. They were all studio records.
I know that, you know.
I booked them on Dick Cavett when they had the 1910 Fruit Gump Company.
Uh-huh.
And the Dick Cavett Show's office was next to mine.
Right.
And the talent coordinator there was sort of a buddy of mine, Susan somebody or other. And she came in one day, and Dick Cavett didn't book rock acts, so we didn't really do anything with him.
Right.
And she was hung up. They had no act. It was when he was doing a morning show.
Right.
And so she said, well, the 1910 Fruit Gump Company, I mean, Simple Simon Says is kind of a novelty record. Kids would like it. We can use them.
Right.
So I called Jeff Katz, and I said, you know, yada yada, and he's like, well, we don't have a group, but we'll get one. So they go across the street to New Jersey, and they find some bar band, and they said, you're the 1910 Fruit Cup Company.
Right.
And Betty's going crazy the next morning trying to get them into the union. That was a big nightmare because they had to be Hagler or Apter to get on.
Right.
And they're learning the lyrics to Simple Simon Says It. They're coming across the George Washington Bridge.
I know how it works, yeah.
But it went okay. She got them in the Union in time, and they were great on the show. It was a good bar band. Most of those bar bands in Jersey were terrific.
Oh, absolutely. Chronologically, you know, as far as your life is concerned, I know, as you mentioned, you became Lynn Barry's manager, but out of that, some great things grew out of that. I know Len was very creative and did more than just had, you know, the hits that we know about with the Dovells and with John Madara. There were some other things that grew out of that situation. Electric Indian and
right.
Of course, Daryl Hall emerged from that situation.
He did. He played on Kemosabe.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, when I left New York, I wasn't in love with the kind of Woodstock music.
Okay.
It just got a little drug heavy for me and a little guitar heavy, and they kind of lost the groove. And I was still interested in disco and discotheques. I still had the club.
Right.
And Lenny offered me, he said, why don't you just come to Philly and take over? Be my manager or whatever. So I went to Philly, made records with him. He had a contract with Madeira, and they were fighting.
Right.
Over some song or whatever.
Right.
So Lenny called me up, and he said, can I do an instrumental? And I said, yeah, as long as you don't sing on it. That doesn't offend the contract.
Right.
Well, he said, it's time for Indians. I said, I beg your pardon? He says, time for Indians. He said, we did real good with Civil Rights, but Indians are really having a tough time. And it was right around the time of Marlon Brando winning the Oscar and sending Sasha Little Flower to
right.
get the Oscar to make a speech and stuff. He said, I want to do an Indian-themed record. I said, okay. So he said, I'm going to go write it now. He said, I'm off to Vince Montana's house. So they put together this instrumental, and it was the players on that record, Mike, other than Daryl Hall played, I think he played a keyboard on that.
Right.
It was all the guys that later became MFSB.
Right.
It was Bobby Eli and Norman Harris and
right.
Nolan Chambers. Earl Young played drums as a trance drummer. And it was all the same dudes. I don't think John Oates played on that, but Tim Moore
right.
probably did.
Right.
And it was funny. Nobody would buy the record.
Uh-huh.
So, and it was this offbeat little instrumental. It was really the first disco record, a funky little disco
wow,
record.
Wow, wow.
And we had done two earlier records with a guy named Grover Mitchell that were stone disco.
Right.
So he put it on his own label. He got it played at WDAS in Philly, Marmaduke Records. And they sold something like 16,000 records in 10 days.
Wow.
And United Artists picked it up, and it became a huge hit. Literally, it's the first disco record.
Wow. And so the sounds of Philadelphia actually grew out of that. According to Len, you know, he said, and Len is still hanging out with Bobby Eli and doing some recordings.
He's got a new album he's working on with Eli. I'm real excited about it.
Yeah, no, I understand that too. And, you know, we want to hear about that when that comes out. I did just about every genre. You know, I did the weddings. I did the top 40 stuff. And I was signed with a group called Devotion. We recorded at Media Sound in New York City.
Sure, and I've been there.
Yeah, of course you have. And with John and Joel, my engineer was Phil Schrager, who was a staff engineer there. And we did something called Dance City by Devotion. It was played in all the disco clubs. And it started to get played, and then it fizzled out because tempos were just changing a little bit. I'll tell you how I signed the deal. I sat at Latin Sound and shoveled white stuff into each nostril of Paco Navarro's nose for about... it's a true story. It's a true story. I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
No, and, it sure is. I never saw that myself.
And he kept looking up and going, "That's a good tune, man. That's a good tune." And I said, and I kept slamming him back down into the seat, saying, "You got to listen to the whole thing." And
whatever gets the deal made,
you know, and whatever. But you know, of course, tempos were changing a little bit, and you know, record companies sign you, and then they put it on the shelf because they're on to something.
We'll be right back. got a boogie.
I've got to get down.
JackBobRadio.com, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Now you don't have to forget if you don't want to. Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa.
say if you want to hang at the bar. Tell you what you gotta do.
Gotta party hard and break it down too.
In those days, I remember John Luongo was hanging out making disco hits in those days, and a couple
He's
of other
genius,
people.
That guy.
Yeah, well,
John
you know,
Luongo, his resume is off the wall.
Do you know that I gave John Luongo about 3 years ago about 20 of my original tunes just to to see what he could do with the tunes. And, I says, yeah, let's see what we can do, because he started a new little company to promote some tunes, to place them and whatever. I haven't spoken to him. Last time I spoke to him was like a year and a half, but he's a good guy.
I talk to him on Facebook all the time. We talk about where the music business is headed a lot.
Yeah, mention my name, he'll smile.
he's really interested in where this is going.
Oh, yeah. He's got a lot of energy, though, John. John is like, when you talk to him, he's like, if you had to graph the whole situation, it would be a straight line across the top of the page,
He's like me.
He's always, exactly, he's got a lot of energy,
He does. He and I are a lot alike, and we're both, we both want to move ahead.
Now, I hear you.
We want to deal with... I believe in dealing what you see in front of you. The only consistent thing I've found in life in my 72 years is change.
No, things change.
And you go with the flow. I'm not one of these guys that criticizes, all the music's terrible that they make today. There's some crap out there, but if we're being honest, there was some crap in the 60s.
You bet. Well, there's some great stuff out there, too. And,
there is.
It's all about... Well, see, I say it differently. I say good music is good music. I mean, you can go back... You can listen to any genre, and good music is good music.
I couldn't agree more.
And there's
crap. Crap gets out there.
No, I know.
There's some bad records. If Rihanna makes the same record one more time, I think I'm going to scream.
No, I understand. But you know what? I was at Media Sound one time, and there was a project going on called Bionic Boogie. And,
I remember that.
Okay.
Risky Changes.
Yep. And the deal with that was, there were an awful lot of talented people. Sissy Houston was there, and Dee Dee Warwick was there, and in the studio adding to that thing. And Whitney was...
That was a great record.
Whitney was about 14 years old, just sucking her teeth, sitting back there, going, when are we getting out of here? And Sissy says, that's my daughter Whitney. She wants to be a model. And about 5 years later, she came out with this huge voice. And I said, holy shit, that was the skinny little girl that wanted to be a model. That was Sissy's daughter. But then again, and this is between you and I, it's my show and I can say it, everybody blames Bobby Brown and this and that and yada,
that's
yada.
Ridiculous.
But you see, unfortunately, Whitney watched all this stuff go on right in front of her and became part of that culture as far as, what they were doing to stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning to record a session and whatever. And she became part of it. So it wasn't, she had that in her too.
Whitney would tell you that. I heard her say it many times.
Yep.
She grew up, she's a street girl.
Yep.
She's just a corner girl from Jersey. And she related to Bobby Brown and those kind of corner guys.
Right.
Very much. And I've heard her say 100 times, I'm not that little princess in a white gown.
Right.
I got a whole nasty side to me.
Right, right.
And you're right, because Bobby Brown lived here in Atlanta. They both did.
Right.
And I know, I've seen Bobby out in the clubs many times. A big drinker, he smokes a lot of weed. But you know what? Coke isn't his thing.
Right.
It really wasn't him. Whitney's responsible for Whitney. She told Diane Sawyer that. It's like Diane didn't believe her.
Right.
And I hate the way it ended up, to be honest with you, because there was no significant amount of either alcohol or drugs found in Whitney's system. That was a slip and fall accident in a bathtub. She slipped at her head and drowned.
Well,
and they're going to make it a drug thing. And I think that's terrible.
Well, you know, the media, you see, unfortunately,
yeah,
in today's day and age, the guys who report the news, they want to be, you know, the stars, and they want to be what it's all about. And they're not. They're only reporting the news, but they think they are the news. So they feel that they can take the story wherever they want to take it because, you know, it's about them. It's, you know, no offense, because I've done it all and whatever, whatever. You know, DJs that are very good and are very humble and, you know how to take a show from beginning to end. But you also know DJs where it's only about the DJ and the music becomes secondary. You know, where does it actually lie? You know what I'm saying? I understand. But
I don't know really how to get that way. I never cared about my press one way or the other. People said I was great, thank you. If they said I was awful, well, I'll try to be better.
Well,
I just never read my own reviews. I don't care. I do the best I can.
There is a delicate balance in all of that stuff, too.
But I did DJing because I loved the music.
Right.
I loved the music more than I loved Dan Ingram, which is why I went to the clubs. they wouldn't let you play it. By about 66, they were not letting you pick your own music.
Right. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
We had these music directors, thought they were smarter than everybody.
Well, they still do that on the stations, and the problem is...
These
music directors are young people that don't even know the demographic, and they're choosing the songs, and
well,
it's...
Well, they have nothing to choose from, Mike, in their defense. They have to play music that comes from the big three RIA record companies. They're not allowed to play independent music.
Right.
That's a deal the Clear Channel and the others made with the devil a long time ago.
Right.
So they don't have much to choose from. You're going to play the new Rihanna, or you're going to play the new Kesha, or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, there's not a big spectrum of music. We had it good. I mean, we could pick anything. If you walked into a station and you said, "Hi, I'm Mike, and here's my record. Would you listen to it?"
Right.
It was great. We played it.
Right. I know. Yeah.
You know, it was a different thing then. It's literally why I got probably the primary reason I got out of radio.
No, I hear you. And I always say you don't have to dress up for radio. That's another way of saying it. You know, it's like...
Well, it's true. Although back in the day, a lot of stations required a suit and tie.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm sure.
They did at WABC. Ingram had to wear a suit and tie until the late 60s.
In case you had people, you know, passing the glass, you know, on these tours, you know.
Yeah.
Don K. Reed always tells the story about how he got into radio. He was on a field trip with his elementary school, and they took him to WWRL, and they passed by, and Hal Jackson actually came out of the booth and talked to him and said, "Hey, kid, you know," and he says, "I want to be a radio guy." And he says, "You know, don't give up. You know, it's like do what you got to do." And he says it was Hal Jackson that inspired him to do radio, and he was only like 9 years old on a field trip, you know. So
Right. It's
hot stuff. Let's go back, because I want to hear your version of this story, because I know you were right there and standing right there. I used to work a club years ago called Clay Cole's World in Roosevelt Field.
Hi, this is Clay Cole. You're on the Harmony Street Show with my good friend Mike Miller.
And one of the acts that my... oldies a cappella group used to open up for was Johnny Maestro and the Crests, when they had Lois Lee in the band and they were doing the Crests. And I also was a regular at the Cloud Nine, and I used to see the Encores and Frenchie and the New Breed and Bobby and the Orbits, and I used to stand there and I knew everybody in the crowd, all the big muscle-bound bouncers. I want you to tell me that whole story about how Johnny and the Satins and the Rhythm Method evolved into the Brooklyn Bridge. You're on.
Okay, well, when I came to New York, and I went to work for Betty Sperber at Action Talents, we already had certain acts signed. The Lemon Pipers were already signed. I brought Lenny, the Dee Dee Sharp, Shangri-La.
Right.
But they already had the Lemon Pipers, the Wild Ones. And they had Johnny Maestro, Betty Mandy, Jim.
Uh-huh.
And so she had. We actually had the same picture with two different logos. One said Johnny Maestro in the crest.
Right.
The other one says Adele Sattins featuring Johnny Maestro.
Right.
And I was allowed to book it either way, depending on what the buyer wanted to buy.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we did.
Wow.
So every, maybe once a month, once every 6 weeks, there was a club out in Long Island, the one you referenced,
yeah,
called Cloud Nine.
Which was the Et Cetera Lounge at one time, and then the Cloud Nine. I know the club because I was a regular there. Go ahead.
And I actually didn't, although I used to go in there occasionally, because I got tight with the owner's girlfriend, but that's another story.
Okay. Yeah,
anyhow, so every so often, Betty would have like a showcase, and she'd invite a bunch of bands. On a Monday night, we'd go take over the club and all these bands would play.
Right.
And it was a way for us to hear new bands.
Uh-huh.
And she always promised the club owner, if you let me do this, take over the club on a Monday night, I'll bring you some act. So one night it was this one and one night it was that one.
Right, right.
So on this particular Monday night, it was Maestro.
Mm-hmm.
He lived nearby.
Right.
So Maestro comes in and he walks up to me and he's, hey, Al, and he says, can I
He lived in Bayshore.
Right.
Yep.
And he said, can any of these bands play? I said, not really. They're all kind of hippie bands, and it's about screaming guitars, and, you know, not really.
Right.
I said, but there's a little eight-piece band that I heard. They're all kids, man. They're like 17, 18 years old.
Uh-huh.
But the keyboard player did, like, arrangements for these bands at West Point or something.
Uh-huh.
I mean, really musical.
Uh-huh.
And he reads music. And they all sing, so maybe you could work something out with them.
Uh-huh.
So he goes into the kitchen, and they rehearse a little bit, and he comes out, he says, these guys are great. We're not only going to do 16 Candles, we're going to do Step by Step, The Angels Listened In, Trouble in Paradise, we're going to do all of it.
Right.
So they did that. And it was great, and, you know, good night. So the next day I come in, and Betty calls me in the office, and she said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm taking Maestro and Adele Sattins, and I'm going to put them in front of this band.
Uh-huh.
I'll put them all together.
Right.
I said, that's 13 people. She said, I fired one of Adele Sattins.
Uh-huh.
I said, okay, well, that's 12 people.
Uh-huh.
I said, what, are you crazy? I'm having enough trouble booking them as 4 people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, 12 people, it'd be easier to sell the Brooklyn Bridge.
Right.
And she said, I love that. That's going to be their name. I said, man, you've been drinking too much coffee, and I'm going home.
Uh-huh.
So I took off, and I forgot about it. I come in the next morning, and nobody's in the office except the receptionist. I said, where's Betty? And she was a little speed freak, the reception. She goes, Betty.
Right.
Betty's on the Brooklyn Bridge with the mayor of Brooklyn, Bill Bogart from Buddha Records,
wow,
Wes Farrell, all the Del Satins, Johnny Maestro, and she goes on and on. And I said, my God, they're actually going to do this.
They're taking pictures.
They were taking pictures.
Right. I know the pictures.
So then a period of time goes by. I don't really remember how long. Betty called me in the office one day. She said, come with me. We're going up to Neil's office on the 4th, 6th floor, whatever it was.
Right.
And we go up there, and Wes Farrell's there. Now, Wes Farrell was a record producer, produced the Cow Sills and also the Partridge Family.
Right.
26 years old, very rich, very successful, real movie star, good looks.
Right.
And he was all full of his stuff.
Right.
And Neil Bogart was also 26 or 27, running Buddha Records. They had hits just running out every window.
Right.
And he was pretty full of himself. So they're screaming at each other. They recorded, I guess, 3 songs with Maestro and Adele Sattins.
Right.
Neil hated them all. I'm not putting that out, he said. And Wes Farrell said, you're deaf. These are great songs. And they're screaming at each other.
Right.
So Johnny leans over to me and says, hey, Alan, I heard this song. It's on a Fifth Dimension album. It's written by Jimmy Webb, who wrote, you know, By the Time I Get to Phoenix and Up and Away. He says, great song. And he said, I could really sing this one good. So I just yelled, hey, at the top of my lungs, if I did it to you, it'd blow your phone up.
Right.
As loud as I could, and everybody stopped. I said, you know, Johnny Maestro is sitting right here, and he's the guy that has to see these things.
Right.
And he's got an idea. How about we could listen to him? What do you think? So Johnny repeated what he had said to me. And this is a true story. And so Neil Bogart goes, fine. And Wes Farrell says, great, we'll do that.
Uh-huh.
And they really picked that tune in anger.
Wow.
And we got out in the hall, and Johnny come over to me, and he's shaking my hand. He says, thanks, man. He says, this is going to be a hit record. I said, well, good. Anytime I can help you. And from then on in, like, he would come over whenever he had a problem. Could you talk to Betty? I was kind of his hammer.
Wow.
but it really got picked in anger. It's a great song. It was a great choice. Wes Farrell produced it, I think. He made it was a great record.
I got a, you know, I did an interview with Billy and Marilyn, you know, a couple of months ago. They were here in Palm Beach,
and Paulette
and I went to see them and hugged them and kissed them. And Billy said to me in the interview, and I will send you the interview. I said, tell me the worst that could happen story. He said, Marilyn was really getting to the forefront with Marry Me Bill and One Less Bell. And when I recorded The Worst That Could Happen, we thought we had an instant hit. He said, the problem was our producers didn't want us to screw around with the fact that Marilyn was stepping forward as being the consummate lead for the Fifth Dimension at that point, and they didn't want to mess with that because she was really riding, you know, a real wave. He said, so we were forced to put her on an album. He said, one day we're driving in the car and we turn on the radio and we hear, girl, I heard you getting, and he says, so Marilyn says, wow, Billy, they're playing your record. And Billy said, no. Our harmony doesn't come in till the middle of the record. There's harmony right at the beginning of this record. That's not me. And then they realized that it was Johnny Maestro and the Brooklyn Bridge. But the rub was with Billy, he said, Johnny sang it note for note for inflection for note the same way I did, which is true.
Hi, this is Billy Davis Jr.
Hi, I'm Alan McCoo.
And you listen to our good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
Girl, I've heard you're getting married. Heard you're getting married. This time you're really sure. And this is the end. They say you really mean it. This guy's the one that makes you feel so safe, so sane, and so secure. And
thank you.
these years. It's just a terrific experience. And you know that now I have the girls and all the members of Harmony Street just love it. Well, we get that's work with a group of kids because that's like the generality.
Well, you know what? And I don't blame him because Billy Davis Jr. is one of the great singers in pop music history.
Yep.
And why screw around if you got it right the first time?
Well, you know, and of course, I knew John very well then because I met John when I was 17. I used to go see John, you know, when we were working at the Raleigh Hotel in the Catskills when he had the whole 11 pieces there and there were three people sitting in the lounge. And I said, why don't you guys sit down and pack up? He said, nope, if there were three people sitting in the lounge, they get the whole show full blast. That's it.
Absolutely.
You know?
The guy I was in a band with, Turk Curry, once told me, we was very slow in the club.
Yeah.
He said, hey, if only one person comes, it's not their fault nobody else came.
That's right.
I
know.
They get the same show. And I do that now. If there's only one person in the club, I'm DJing it like I'm on WABC.
If they leave,
I stop talking, let the music play, go to the bar.
But if
there's only one person, I'm still rocking it.
Well, you know, and of course, we talk about great clubs and all the places. Going back to New York City, Arthur's Discotheque. Do you remember a group called the Fuzzy Bunnies that used to play in that club?
No.
Yeah.
But when I was there, Betty was an early investor in Arthur. Ah. We had the wild ones in there.
Well, you know, Jordan Christopher started with a doo-wop group.
Are you as beautiful as I think you are? Or is it my imagination? Can it be love I feel? Or is it fascination?
Betty got that call. I was sitting there. She picked up the phone. It was Jordan.
Uh-huh.
And he said, Sybil Burton, we're talking
right.
about, Richard Burton's ex-wife,
right.
who owned Arthur.
Right.
And he said to Betty, Sybil and I are getting married.
Wow.
And Betty said to him, Jordan, stop it. I'm doing the books here. I haven't got time to screw around. Don't
right.
be fooling around with me.
Right.
No, he said, we're getting married. And she didn't believe him, so he said, well, hang on. And he put Sybil on.
Uh-huh.
Sybil said, hi, Betty, it's Sybil. Yeah, we're getting married.
Oh, wow.
And they did. Now, she was like 50. He was like, I don't know, 20. Yeah. When I came to New York, Betty had been an early investor in Arthur. And so so the Wild Ones were booked in there, and they were the house band.
Wow.
And I never had to book them. They never left. The whole year I was there, they were the house band, 1968.
Well, you know, Stevie Tyler started as a doo-wop guy, too.
Really? I didn't know that.
Absolutely, he did.
A lot of guys started with Joey D, huh?
Well, you know, David Brigati's a very good friend of mine, and, you know, if you really want to hear the truth about everything, you just talk to David for 15 minutes. You know, David really was the brains behind the Rascals.
Was he?
No two ways about it. Oh, yeah.
I knew their manager, Sid Bernstein, but I didn't know the Rascals.
David arranged every bit of the music, and David was on every record as a vocalist on all of those records, too, you know. And of course,
I think Grooving by that stands alone.
Oh, yeah.
Grooving on a Sunday afternoon. Really couldn't get away too soon. Anything we like to do. There's always lots of things that we can see. We can't be anyone we like to be. All those happy people we could meet, just do that on a Sunday afternoon. Get away too soon. No, 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 no. We'll keep on spending sunny days this way. We're gonna talk and laugh our time away. I feel it coming closer day by day. Life will be ecstasy, you and me endlessly moving on a Sunday afternoon. Really couldn't get away too soon. No, 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 no.
Hi, this is Dave Brigati. I used to sing in the late 50s with the High Fives on Decca Records. Then I joined Joey D and the Starlighters with the Peppermint Twist and Shout and Hot Pastrami and Mashed Potatoes. And then I sang on all of the Rascal hits, luckily on Atlantic Records. And you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show. There's never been a record before or since.
Special
like
record.
That.
Special.
Yeah,
record.
Absolutely. It's a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah.
That's a record. Grooving is a record that I give a 40 to. I score records. You get 10, a scale of 1 to 10 for lyric, melody, performance, and production.
Right.
So you could get a 40. And the 40 would be like Bohemian Rhapsody or Vogue.
Right.
And Grooving to me is a 40.
Wow. Well,
no mistakes. No mistakes on that record. That's just a masterpiece.
You know, I have in my mind, as do most music people, like a little side special list of tunes that I think were well sung, well played, and well recorded. And on that list, even though, you know, most people wouldn't think that I go that way, I could think of almost everything that the Eagles ever recorded. I could think of, you know, just like certain tunes. There was a tune called Smoke from a Distant Fire that was so... Sanford Townsend, so well recorded every lick.
Great record.
Now I'm going to tell you, my cousin Adrian married a guy by the name of Gary Katz when they were both kids. And Gary Katz was grew out of the situation with Sandy, Howie, Marty, and all the guys from Jay and the Americans, you know, that hung in the same neighborhood. And, you know, Becker and Fagan were backup players with Steely Dan, and they were plucked out of the, you know, the rhythm section from Jay and the Americans and became Steely Dan, really? And my cousin Gary put them together. So I have to add in there, a lot of the tunes that Steely Dan did were perfect records, but you can go into every genre. Now,
oh yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's perfect records in country and in R&B and there's crap records. There's awful records.
I loved disco because to me, somebody says to me disco sucked, I say to them, you're not polished enough to understand. and you're not polished enough to understand the production. I said, because disco was the big band sound of the 70s. It was big, it was big band.
It brought back the horns.
You bet.
And the strings.
You know?
And the singing and the harmony and the groove. And it kind of un-Woodstocked music.
Although there
was a parallel universe.
Right.
Of Jethro Tull.
Oh, you bet.
And you know, to be fair, I played Dream On
right
in discos because I'm a guy who's always going to play
right.
Tull songs even though nobody else did. And so there was a parallel universe of rock, but disco brought back the groove.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, listen, I know Artie Kornfeld very well as well. You know, he lives down here. You know, Artie, and I knew John and Joel from Media Sound as well. They put up the money for Woodstock because I did a lot of recording there, most of it being disco. And
guys were funny. I was on a TV show, Maury Povich's show, with them, and they told the story of Woodstock. They're a couple of funny guys.
Oh yeah, oh absolutely.
That was the night that the idea for Saturday Night Fever was born, on that Maury Povich show.
Yeah, tell me about that.
That was funny. I got booked on the show by a friend of mine. I don't know how she knew Maury, but I was working the Baltimore market. This was
right.
Like 75.
Right.
And she calls me, can you do Maury Povich's Washington, D.C. talk show? It's a very popular show called Panorama. And I said, sure, why am I doing it? She said, because you're the first disco DJ, which was true. I said, okay, well, that's kind of skinny, but all right. So I go down there, and it was skinny. So I'm on with a guy named Nick Cohen. He spelled his first name N-I-K.
Uh-huh.
And he's a very well-known British writer.
Maybe he couldn't afford all the letters in those days.
About this, yeah, right. I guess his royalty check hadn't come yet.
Right.
About the same age as Maury and I. So
right.
we have our segment, 15 minutes, and we talk about the 50s because we're from that generation.
Right.
And the conversation revolves around, were the 50s more like Rebel Without a Cause or Happy Days?
Right.
And we resolved it by saying, you know, it was a little bit of each.
Right.
So then the segment's over, and Maury turns to me, and he says, so disco's next, huh? I said, Bet the Farm. So then he turns, the credits are almost rolling. He turns to Nick Cohen, and he kind of slaps him on the knee, and he says, you know what you ought to do, man? You ought to take Rebel Without a Cause and rewrite it and make it a disco movie. That's it. See you tomorrow. Well, Nick Cohen went home and took that idea. He didn't write a script. He wrote a story for New York Magazine. I forget what the title of it is. Forgive me. But it basically was a rewrite of Rebel Without a Cause.
Wow.
And it was a disco story.
Wow.
So I don't know what period of time went by, a few months or whatever, and he got a call from England from his friend Robert Stigwood, who was the manager of the Bee Gees.
Right.
And Robert said, what are you working on? I want to do a musical with the Bee Gees. And Nick said, nothing. I haven't got anything. I've been working on that Rock Dreams book. I really don't have anything. I wrote an article for New York Magazine. That's the only thing I have. And, you know, so he said, well, send me that. So he sent him the New York Magazine article, and he got a call like 2 days later, and he said, okay, that's it. We want to option it. This is what we're going to do.
Right.
And the movie Saturday Night Fever came from that story. And now I'm working down in Atlanta, and the movie comes out, and it's huge. So I go see it in the afternoon, because I'm working at night. And I'm looking at a matinee, and I stay, because I didn't make the connection. I'm honest with you, I didn't make the connection between Rebel and John Travolta and all
uh-huh.
that. And they're rolling the credits, and I stay, because I have friends there. You know, the Tramps have a record there, and I want to see who gets writing credits. So I'm reading the credits. And it says, based on a short story by Nick Cohen, N-I-K, C-O-H-E-N.
Well,
and it just came together in my mind that I didn't know then what had happened. I didn't know he'd written the article. I didn't know he knew Stigwood. I had no idea. And I said, my God. And then I looked into it and found out. It's like a Forrest Gump thing. I mean, I didn't have anything to do with thinking of that.
Wow.
But if I hadn't been on Maury Povich's show.
Wow.
They wouldn't have been talking about disco.
Well, you know, the mighty oak from the acorn grows. You know, Dennis Lambert is a good friend of mine, and he always tells me the story about how we talked Stigwood into letting Tavares have a couple of tunes on that album because he was producing.
No, that didn't work.
Yeah.
They had a version. They had the original single on More Than a Woman, and
yeah.
It didn't work. The DJs had to cover them.
Right. No, I remember, but they were also on the album.
Yeah, oh, yeah, they were.
Yeah.
I was on a TV show with them, with Tavares and the rest of them.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I remember. getting back to Baltimore, you know, my wife was a Baltimore girl. My wife was Miss Maryland.
Really?
And yes, she was. And then she went to the Miss USA. And then she became the runner-up in the Miss World contest. And her the person who escorted her during the Miss World contest, where she became first runner-up, was none other than our mutual friend Michael O'Hara.
Ah, Mike O'Hara. He is one of the most unbelievable cats I ever met. He's like a Hugh Hefner that leaves the house. I told you I got offered a job as an agent in D.C. at Paramount Artists.
Right.
And when I first got there, he was the first person that my boss introduced me to. Mitch Corday says, Michael O'Hara is going to be your account. He has this singles organization. And you're going to be booking bands for him. I said, okay. I figured he had a few hundred people. He had 30,000 members.
Right. And he, as the legend would tell it, was really the originator and the father of the sports bar in America, and
he invented the sports bar. That's true.
But and the singles clubs.
Well, and the singles clubs. People tell you he invented disco, but he didn't. He got it from me. because he had a place called Tramps, which is regarded as one of the first discos in America.
Right.
But before it was Tramps, it was an Emerson Steakhouse. And he was a consultant for Emerson's, and he booked me in there. I could send you a picture of me with the mayor of Baltimore naming me the evening mayor of Baltimore because I was doing a thing after work, trying to get people staying down after work.
Right.
And I hipped him to disco when I left there because Emerson's was falling apart as a corporation.
Right.
And I left. I was on air for a few weeks. He turned it into Tramps. But absolutely, he gets credit for inventing singles clubs themselves and inventing singles bars, Gentleman 3.
Right.
First, Gentleman 1, Gentleman 2, Gentleman 3.
Right.
And absolutely for sports bars. Champions was the first sports bar. The idea of combining a bar and music and sports was absolutely his. He is a genius, that guy.
Well, you know, and that's what they say. And, you know, I guess the funny part is, you know, Michael still considers himself, after all these years, one of the world's most eligible bachelors, having never been married.
It's true. He doesn't date anymore, however.
And having dated some of the most beautiful women in the world, of which my wife was one, and Michael will attest to that. So, you know, there is that. As a matter of fact, Michael and I talk to each other all the time on Facebook, and he listens to
I do too.
He listens to show all the time.
Have you ever seen his poster?
Absolutely.
You know, the Farrah Fawcett poster,
right,
with the big hair and a big smile, pink swimsuit, that is out of print. And so now Michael's poster, and for your audience, the one we're talking about is this guy dressed up like an English gentleman with his foot up on, I think it's a Bentley.
Right.
And he's wearing a kind of a golf cap. And he says, and the logo says, poverty sucks.
Yeah.
And that is now the number one selling poster of all time.
Right. Well, I know that Michael has donated quite a few of his memorabilia to the Smithsonian, and he's quite a collector. I'm going to send you later on tonight or tomorrow a picture of Paulette at the Miss World with Michael.
Cool. He probably posted it.
I'm sure that he has. But, you know, Paulette has only beautiful, fond, wonderful memories of him and has told me so many times, you know, what a fabulous human being he was and is, and what a genius that he really was, you know, in some of the things that he accomplished.
He was a weird dude. He made all this money, and he drove a Corvette, but he just rented a room in some guy's house because he was never home. And he had this crazy temper where just anything would just set him off. He started screaming at you, but he got over it real quick.
Right.
One time he did a party at a Marriott Hotel Joppa over in Alexandria, Virginia.
Right.
And I got there late. And I booked two bands in there. One of them didn't show.
They had two points.
And as soon as the elevator door opens, the ante room there to get off is all crowded with people there getting their name signed up and moving, paying their cover charge and stuff.
Right.
It's pretty packed. He's on the other side. He sees me, and he starts screaming. And I know I'm in trouble because one of the bands didn't show. By the time I get to him, he's like, "Ah, don't worry about it, man. We got another band going up here." He's an amazing person.
Well, because he was living in the moment.
Mike, that's really a smart thing to say.
Yeah, he was in the moment all the time.
I actually hire people and work with people that are in the moment. That's what I look for.
Yeah.
I look for people that are awake, that are right there.
Well, you know, if you spend most of your energy trying to fix yesterday and most of your energy, the other half of your energy trying to figure out, like, what to do next Thursday, you're missing the now, man.
Right.
You're going to have a terrible now.
Right. I've always been that way. I remember, I think it was Larry King asked Richard Nixon about Watergate in an interview. Uh-huh. And he said, yesterday's gone, tomorrow's uncertain.
Right.
I kind of live in the moment.
No, it's got to be.
I don't really think much about Watergate.
No, I
don't. And I don't know if anybody else believed him, but I'm a fan of Nixon. And I did believe him. I think he didn't. I think he was living in the moment and just put it behind him.
Right. No, I know.
I think.
I hear you. What I want to ask you is this. What are some of Alan White's favorite tunes? If you had to give me like a top 5 or 6 list, what are some of your favorite tunes? And they don't have to be in the same genre. What are some of the tunes that really turn you on that you find yourself gravitating to over and over again?
Well, through the years, I mean, it's hard to say. My favorite tune is the one I'm listening to right now.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I don't know, Royals. But of the tunes through the years, I think Come Fly With Me by Sinatra is in my top 5.
Right.
Be My Baby, Bohemian Rhapsody, Time and Tide by Basha.
Right.
And I think the best record to me ever made is Vogue. It's not my favorite, but it's the best combination of melody, lyric, performance, and production I've ever heard.
Wow.
For me. That's just for me. But, wow. I mean, I like so much music. I mean, I could make a top 500 list of these songs on.
Right. No, I understand.
There's a lot of great records. How can you listen to the Ode to Billy Joe and that not be your favorite record? Or Abraham, Martin, and John, or anything the Beatles ever did.
Right.
You know?
Right.
The Beatles' whole career. I mean, you can't really pick Elton John, too. I mean, almost every Elton John. Candle in the Wind. Has there ever been a better record than that?
No, you're right. You know, but you see, the Beatles were given the opportunity to grow and evolve and whatever. A lot of groups don't get that opportunity to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do, and then just grow. And they grew. They took that opportunity.
I'll tell you why. Because everybody wants to be the Beatles.
Right.
But nobody wants to do the work.
Yeah, okay.
You know, when the Beatles started, let's get this straight. They dressed alike.
Right.
They wore suits and ties.
Right.
They wore a little Beatle boots.
Right.
And they were a cover band.
Correct.
And what they would do is they would play in some club, and they played great covers of, you've heard all the stuff, Long Tall Sally,
right,
Rolled Over Beethoven, and all the early stuff that they did.
Right.
And then they would put in one of their originals.
Uh-huh.
And the deal was, if the crowd really liked the original, they'd leave it in.
Right.
And if they didn't, they'd take it out.
Uh-huh.
And a year or two went by, and the next thing you know, they had really dropped all the covers.
Uh-huh.
But they started as a cover band, they did the work, they earned the right with their songwriting and their performance. There's never been a band that sounded anything like the Beatles before or since.
No, you're right. Well, and they did study the music. They were great aficionados of the music.
Well, they were geniuses.
Right.
Two geniuses in the same band. In every great band, there's one guy, sometimes more, but at least one guy that hears shit other people don't hear.
No, yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. And that's
why. And they had two of them.
You're right. And now I'm going to make a statement. I was more of a McCartney guy for some reason. I don't know why, but I was. And, you know.
I'll tell you why. Probably because you perceived him as being the melody writer and you're a great singer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're always a guy who looks for melody.
Right.
And it was considered that Lennon was sort of the lyricist, the intellectual of the group.
Yeah. No,
that isn't true, by the way.
Yeah. Okay.
John Lennon explained this once on a Tom Snyder show.
Uh-huh.
And he went down every song.
Uh-huh.
And I remember on Eleanor Rigby, he said, that's a Paul McCartney tune. He said, I never went near it.
Right.
Proving that Paul McCartney can write a lyric if he'll only try.
Right.
And that's a great lyric.
Yeah, I got
And
you.
Then the next song Tom Snyder asked him about was All You Need Is Love. And Lennon smiled, and he said, and that, sir, is a John Lennon tune that Paul McCartney never went anywhere near, proving that John Lennon can write a melody if you only try. The truth is, they wrote separately, they wrote together, and they helped each other many, many times during this interview, because he went over every single song. If you want, he did the same thing in the issue of Playboy magazine with Rita Jenrette on the cover.
Uh-huh.
Very hard to find, but if you find that, he did every single song. Who did what? And in that, John Lennon goes over every single song and he tells you who did the lyric, who did the melody. And a lot of times, they did each other's middle eight. John would come to Paul with a song and Paul would write the middle eight.
I gotcha.
Which is a good idea when you think about it, because you're lost in the sort of verse and chorus thing that you're doing.
I hear you.
The middle eight's going to be totally different, so it's great to get another like perspective on that. I never really thought about it until tonight when we're having this conversation.
Yep.
But that's probably why Lennon and McCartney did that so often, because John said that a lot that night in that interview.
Uh-huh.
That's my song, Paul's middle eight, or that's Paul's song, my middle eight.
Gotcha.
They did that a lot. And that makes perfect musical sense to me now that you bring it up.
No, I hear you. Were you an Elvis fan?
Yeah, sure. Until he got into the jumpsuit and all that crap.
Yeah, I was less of an Elvis fan than I probably should have been. There were certain things that he did that were great. I mean, I remember watching... I remember seeing him, you know, people will argue, but I remember seeing him on the Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey show, you know, which was really the first time he was on, not the Sullivan show.
It was, before Sullivan.
I do remember that, and, you know, everybody was dazzled by him, but I don't know if I was as big an Elvis fan as I could have been. You know, it's funny, my Harmony Street group was the entertainment for Bill and Hillary at the White House at the 98 Christmas party. Okay,
yeah.
That, how we got that is a whole story in itself. It's a book and a movie. But, you know, it just had to do with the planets being right. But I will tell you that, you know, we were doing doo-wop and he loved Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, but he wanted an Elvis tune. You don't do any Elvis?
With all of the phenomenon that come along in music, they change the music.
Uh-huh.
You know, if Justin Bieber changed the music, he'd be Elvis.
Right.
But he's making bad Usher records.
Yeah, I hear you.
He's not changing the music. When Benny Goodman came along and did his thing with Sing, 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 that famous story of the college campus out in L.A.
Right.
Or San Francisco, wherever it was. I mean, nobody ever heard music like that before.
Right.
It was all Paul Whiteman, sweet music.
Uh-huh.
And the music changed. When Sinatra came along, especially in the 50s, when he really came into his own, he changed the music. This was big band vocals.
Right.
There weren't many vocals in the big band era. Sinatra became the era of the big band singer.
Right.
He really changed the music. Elvis changed the music.
Right.
The Beatles changed the music. Disco changed the music. And so did hip-hop.
Right.
But there's no big breakout star in hip-hop.
There were the forerunners and whatever.
Well, there's a lot of them. I mean, there's Curtis Blow and there's Gil Scott Heron, Winter in America in 75 is the first hip hop.
I remember a tune called, as far as rap stuff goes, I remember a tune called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. I thought that was the first rap record. Remember that?
That's Gil Scott Heron's album. Gil Scott Heron put out an album in 75 called Winter in America.
Uh-huh.
And on it was a song called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
I remember.
Which, of course, isn't true. It'll be on CNN.
Yeah.
But he didn't know that then. And that is considered to be ground zero for hip-hop.
Right.
What's weird is on that same album is a record called The Bottle.
Uh-huh.
And it's a disco record.
Uh-huh.
And it is the first disco record ever to become an international smash with absolutely no radio.
Wow.
And the funny part, we're playing it in clubs, and it's about alcoholism.
Wow.
It's a great record, and it's on that same album. And so, he died a couple of years ago, but whenever Gil Scott Heron would go to these hip-hop festivals, because he was ground zero, him and DJ Herc would headline.
Right.
And he play his big hit was a disco record. No rap in it at all. He sings it.
I got
it. If you listen to Winter in America, you're absolutely right, Mike. The kind of rap style that evolved started with that.
Wow.
It started with Steve Allen and Jack Kerouac in The Village.
Wow.
But modern hip hop started with
that. Wow.
This.
I got a media sound story for you, all right?
And
you're going to know the tune. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning in the lounge. You know, they had the church, the big room where Manilow used to record. And then upstairs, they had the lounge, which was a smaller studio. In the lounge at 3 o'clock in the morning is Frankie Valli singing over and over a section of a tune with Charlie Colello standing over him going, no, no, I don't think so. Give it to me again. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And the tune that Frankie recorded, they eventually put on an album. But Colello took it away from him and gave it to a group called Odyssey. And by the following Friday, it was being played by Paco and BLS, and it became like a huge disco hit. It was called You're a Native New Yorker. But
yeah,
Frankie...
Native New Yorker is a classic.
I love that tune, but Frankie recorded it first.
I didn't know that, but I did know that Charlie Colello produced it.
Oh, yeah. Charlie lives...
I saw that on the 12-inch. I played that a lot. I still play it a lot.
You want to know something? I could listen to... That's one of those tunes I could listen to 16 times in a row and then, you know, walk away and still be humming it. Yeah.
It also works for me as a programmer because I still play slow music. I'm always going to play slow music to give the guys a chance to hug and squeeze with the girls to uh-huh. make a deal. And that record starts with a saxophone.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And it's a great record to come out of a ballad with. Just as the ballad's fading, you drop that saxophone.
Right.
And then it just kind of rambles around for a second, and then it goes to the groove. Boop, 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 boop.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's a bluesy sax. Yeah, it's a great sax. Tell me how you got involved with swing.
Oh, that's a funny story.
Go ahead.
There was a movie called The Swing Kids. I have always believed, from the time it went away until today, that partner dancing would come back. It's been around for thousands and thousands of years, and just because, you know, the twist kind of broke partners apart, and then we had hippies, and everybody was too drugged up to dance.
Right.
And it kind of broke away, and then hip-hop, of course, is breakdancing.
Right.
Which is a solo dance. But I always figured it was going to come back. So there's a movie called The Swing Kids, and I went to see it with my wife. It's a great story about Nazi Germany, actually.
Right.
And the Nazis are trying to get all the young people to sign up to the Nazi youth organization. And there's uh-huh. a bunch of young people that don't want to do that. All they want to do is dance to Benny Goodman records.
Right.
And Count Basie records. And they're called The Swing Kids.
Gotcha.
So all this music was played, and they showed all these kids dancing. And I remember I walked out of the theater, and my wife said to me, "Are you trying to tell me that's going to come back?" I said, "I don't know, maybe." So a few years went by, and all of a sudden, in 1998, summer of 1998, really
right.
spring, this started to come back with the Zoot Suit Riot by the Cherry Poppin' Daddies and the Big Bad Voodoo Daddies and a Gap commercial with Louis Prima do a Jump, Jive, and Whale.
Right.
So I'm working some club in the Atlanta suburbs, and I'm knocking down a pretty good paycheck. Everything's fine. And I get a call from a friend of mine, and he says, "We're doing this club down in Midtown for all the college kids, and we got 25 or 30 grand. We're going to take a shot here." And, you know, yada, yada. And I said, "Nah, I'm kind of happy where I am." And because my wife figured I'd never get in front of the swing, because I thought you're going to get in front of college kids at your age.
Right.
So before I hung up with him, I said, "What kind of music did you want me to play?" "Well," he said, "we want to play that swing music, Grafton and Swing Kids." I said, "I'll take it." So I quit, went downtown, and I became the swing DJ in town, almost by accident. And the local radio station, Sean Demery at Power 99, came in, because they had broken swing. They were an alternative station, and swing broke alternative.
Right.
He came in, brought all his listeners, and so I became the swing DJ.
Wow.
And it faded after that summer. And then the kids started looking backwards to the old bands as opposed to forward with the neo swing. And it uh-huh. became kind of a different thing, but I kept them for about 15 years.
Right.
And they're wonderful kids, college kids. They're all in their mid-30s now. They have kids. We have a reunion every once in a while.
Wow.
And there were hundreds of them. And it was great fun. I had them at a Marriott Hotel, a reunions lounge at a Marriott Hotel for, I guess, about 10 years. I raised two kids off that money.
Wow. You know, I think it's important as you move through the decades for, you know, the kids of now to understand how we got here rather than just saying, "Yo, this is my music and I love my music." To understand, you know, you understand your own music much more when you understand how you got there, you know.
I think they get it. They get it by osmosis. It's hard for me to tell because my kids, who don't like anything other than current music, uh-huh. my oldest son's an aspiring EDM DJ,
okay,
or producer,
right.
And my youngest son is—he's 19. He's Mr. Hip Hop.
Gotcha.
And they don't like the stuff I listen to,
right?
But they don't realize that they know that music.
I hear you.
And when it comes back, they're going to say, "Yeah, my father used to play crap like that."
Yeah, right.
And then they see movies that take them back. So they get a taste of where it has all come from. Personally, I think it should be required in school for everyone to see Ken Burns' History of Jazz.
Okay.
Because that's a 16-hour show.
Right.
16 weeks, an hour each. And mm-hmm. if you change the title to A History of Black People in America,
gotcha.
that would be perfect.
I hear you.
It's because music and race are so intertwined.
It becomes
the politics of the 20th century, the music of the 20th century, the culture of the 20th century. All music has been such an important part of everything we did. The Beatles changed the world. So did Elvis.
No, I understand. So, you know, I always
disco.
I always say the one place, you know, I was very lucky. I got to be a fly on the wall in a lot of great places. At Media Sound, I was there on a regular basis, you know, like in the middle of the night and during the day and whenever I wasn't doing anything because, you know, I had a very good friend that was a staff engineer there and I got to see a lot of the greats record right in front of me, you know, and I learned a lot by osmosis and everything else. So I was kind of lucky, but you know, it was really funny when you talk about race and this and that. When you're in a recording studio, you're making music. That's one of the times that, man, you never see color. I mean, in as many groups as I've sung with on stage and this and that and whatever, you know, that's the one place you never see color, man. Or you're hitting harmony with three or four other guys, and you know, it's only about the music, man.
You know, you need to thank your friend Elvis for that.
Yeah.
Because Elvis really, along with Chuck Berry and a few others, they merged country and R&B.
Yeah.
That's what rock and roll is. Rock and roll is country and R&B. Yeah. Hank Williams was a blues singer.
I hear you.
Yeah. And when it comes together, you're right, we didn't see color.
How has the music business changed as you see it? I mean, of course, you can't just go in and cut a record anymore and give it to a distributor. You know, people are putting their stuff either on iTunes or Amazon or YouTube if they just give up and they want the world to have it. How do you feel about that?
Well, we're in the middle of a change, and it hasn't completely changed yet. What happened was the record company, Daryl Hall said in an interview recently when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, okay. They asked him, were you surprised to be there? And he said, you bet, these aren't my friends. These
right.
are music business, record business people.
Right.
Record business is organized crime.
Right, right.
And to a certain extent, he's right.
No,
and what the record company did was, in 1985, they killed the single.
Yep.
So they had this monopoly. They owned radio. You had to pay $17 to get the one song you wanted. You had to buy the whole CD.
Right.
You couldn't, records were very expensive to make, $5,000 or $10,000 for a single, $100,000 for an album.
Right.
You had to have their financing.
Right.
They owned all the distributors, so you couldn't get a record distributed even if you got it played.
Right.
So they had a 100% monopoly. Well, then along comes the internet. Well, the internet becomes the delivery system for music, and they lose their distributors.
Uh-huh.
Computers become the way we make music, and they lose the monopoly they had over financing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's not an album world anymore. They couldn't shove these albums down our throat. Now it's a singles world.
Right.
So every single component of the record industry's monopoly was starting to vanish. So they passed the Millennium Copyright Act. They hired a Democratic lobbyist named Hillary Rosen, made her the head of the RIAA.
Right.
And she got this law passed that said, you don't own the music.
Right.
You only own the right to listen to it.
Uh-huh.
They actually try to enforce that retroactively, which is hysterical. That means that if I bought Hushabye by the Mystics
right.
in 1958,
right.
I don't own it.
Yeah.
Right. So that's nonsense. But anyhow.
Yeah.
So well, when they did this, it turned out that record buyers don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't buy it, they'll download it.
Right.
Simple as that.
Right.
So now they have these streaming services, Pandora,
right.
Spotify.
Right. TuneIn Radio.
iTunes has one. Amazon, I think, has one. Google's starting one.
Right.
And the record companies are big investors in Spotify and Pandora because they can take the profits, if there are any out of there, and not have to pay the artists.
Right.
Just the big three. And that's kind of where we are, and everybody's trying to break through that. And the blockade yeah. is radio.
Yeah.
If you do a record now,
mm-hmm.
you and Dion go do a record, your
right.
buddies.
Right.
And you have a great record. You can't get it played on radio because they only play records by the RIAA.
Right.
And we're not allowed to play RIAA records on the internet.
Right.
Unless we have this very expensive license.
Right.
I think that what's going to change is, number one, I suspect that radio's going to have to make a move here because they're having trouble selling commercials as it is. They were all living on their morning shows.
You bet.
And all of a sudden the internet's in cars and they're losing their morning show audience.
Well, I have said 100 times in the car, people are telling me this too, that everything's going to be Wi-Fi soon. All the music's going to move, you know, terrestrial radio
right.
is going to disappear. And when you want jazz, you'll go Wi-Fi and you'll have 800 choices from all over the world. And that's the end of the story.
Suppose you did this, Mike.
Yeah.
Suppose you were a young entrepreneur and you started an online radio station,
mm-hmm.
an internet radio station.
Right.
And you went and hired guys with the talent level of Joey Reynolds and Big Dan Ingram.
Right.
but young kids, but with that talent left.
Right.
And you only played independent music because the record companies only own 1% or 1% or 1% or 1% or 1% of music in the world.
Correct.
Just go find all the great music in the world, find yourself 30 or 40 records, and create a station.
Mm-hmm.
Independent music, offer the music you're playing for sale right from the site. That's a revenue stream for internet radio,
right.
And the artist would be delighted.
Right.
Make an iTunes type arrangement, play it, promote it, and sell it.
Right.
If you did that, and the artist said, you and your little Dion record, you
right.
said, well, you know what? You can buy our record. We'll allow you to do that. You own it. If you want to share it with your friend, go ahead. Just don't resell it.
Right.
I think everything changes.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of waiting for something along those lines to happen. I'm working on a television show that'll be on the internet. And if that happens, we will only play independent music. We will sell it from the site.
Uh-huh.
And if the TV show catches on, well, then other people might start to copy us.
Well,
and then terrestrial radio's got to follow because they're getting killed out there. Who's
right.
listening to radio?
Nobody.
Right. And how are you going to sell commercials if nobody's listening? And these are very, very big investments these days.
I hear you. Well, you know, listen, I do this show because I love it. And I've done hundreds of interviews, you know, in the 6 years that I'm doing this. And basically, I do it because I love it. And I try to stay creative. And I'm still recording and singing and doing it, you know, whatever. But I do this because I get a great joy out of it. And I've probably done every biggie, you know, in the business, you know, barring, you know, one or two. But, you know, nobody's really figured out how to harness internet radio in really making big bucks out of it.
Right. Well, they can't play RIA music, so that's been their big handicap.
Yep.
They can't play Rihanna. They can't play Lady Gaga. They can't
right.
play the hits.
Right. I hear you.
And they haven't reached out and tried to put talent back on.
Well, the bottom line for all of that is everything seeks its level, and this whole genre right now is still in the process of seeking its level. It's newfound territory.
EDM is not it. EDM is disco through a computer.
Right.
It's white dance music, which is almost an oxymoron.
Right.
Black people are still hung up on 90 beats a minute
right.
and hip-hop.
Uh-huh.
The only black guy that seems to be paying attention is Pharrell Williams. He had the three biggest records of the year last year.
Uh-huh.
Get Lucky, Blurred Lines, and Happy. They're all up-tempo records.
Uh-huh.
All the rest of R&B is just laying there, man. John Legend and Cathers, 90 beats a minute. All the hip hop, 80 beats a minute. We have 20 years of that. It's too slow.
Spoken like a true DJ. Let me ask you, Alan, if you had this whole thing to do over again, what would you change? What would you have done differently?
Well, you can't do everything. You know, I mean, I had a chance to be an attorney once. It's a long story, but law's a hobby of mine. I would have loved it. But you can't do everything, you know?
Right.
Somebody asked me, what would you do if you came back? Would you be a lawyer? And I said, well, maybe, but not before I tried to be Bobby Darin.
Yeah. So no regrets as far as your music career. I mean, that was just something you lived and you loved.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think you just gave me a title for my biography, A Fly on the Wall.
There you go.
I wanted to use Rebel Without Applause,
uh-huh.
but Lenny's using that, and that's way better.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, Rebel Without Applause is great, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, so do I. But Fly on the Wall is pretty good, too. I don't know. You brought the record up, Dion's Wanderer.
Right.
And there was also a television show called Route 66, which uh-huh. is two guys that wandered the country.
Right.
And I was inspired by those two things.
Uh-huh.
I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. I just kind of wander around and have adventures.
There you go. You know,
and so I got to do that, and I'm still doing it.
Talk about being in the moment.
Yeah, and I just would I do it different? Well, sure. You know, Lenny and I should have gone to L.A. He'll tell you that.
Uh-huh.
Sure, you could have made this move here or made that move there, but then you wouldn't have done this other thing.
Right.
So, you know, if there's an addition to your life, there's always a subtraction.
All right.
So not really, no. I mean, I had a pretty good time. I'm still having a big time.
Yeah, right. So the bottom line is that you're not done yet. You got a lot of...
What I'm trying to do here is bring back partner dancing, an internet television show similar to Bandstand, create an internet network similar to CNN, but for teenagers. It changed the music and make people dress up again. It's a big bite.
Cool.
But why not?
Cool.
There's a big hole in music right now. I'm telling you, I'm serious. Black people are really hung up in hip-hop.
Right.
It's over.
Right.
Rock has gone to country.
Right.
This is wide open.
Right.
And anybody can do anything. It's artist-driven. Some kid's going to come along and capture the heart and imagination of the teenagers, and it's going to blow up. And I'm not sure what, but I'm pretty sure partner dancing is coming back. It's huge in England under the name Modern Jive.
Right.
There's partner dancing everywhere. There are clubs everywhere. Colleges have ballrooms. Clubs and Georgia Tech has a swing association.
So people are going to fall in love at first sight again, huh?
Well,
they'll be touching each other.
It's going to be the same but different, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Based upon but different from.
Yeah. No, that's
but
great.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, we've had these 20 years of kind of gangster worship, which I understand. I mean,
right.
We had it during the 50s, too. We looked up at the Bob guy for the same reason.
Yeah, I got you.
They were the ones that sold liquor during Prohibition. And the drug war produced these kind of gangsters.
Uh-huh.
And I understand that, but it's over. It played out. So something else will come along. I think people will dress up again. The fashion industry would be a big promoter of this because they need to sell some new clothes. So they can't keep selling these nice sneakers. Nobody buying them.
No, that's true.
So they need a new fad. You know, if we remember when the Elvis hit, that changed fashion. When the Beatles hit, that sure changed fashion.
Sure.
Pods and all that. When disco hit, that changed fashion.
Oh, that certainly was dress up. I had fun with that.
The leisure suits and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and yeah. So, I mean, I think the time is right to make it happen again. And somebody just has to go out there and do it. So I'm working on the project.
Oh, very cool. You know, Alan, I am thrilled that you have taken the time out to talk to me about your life and give me some insight into your feelings about the music business. And it's just been great talking to you and spending this time with you tonight.
It's always good to talk to you, Mike. You and I have a lot of the same experiences, a lot of the same friends. And we've been a lot of the same places at different times. So.
No, that's definitely true. And, of course, I'll be talking to you after this, and I want you to keep me posted as to what you're doing creatively, you know, because I'm very interested in that, and I hope to be talking to you very, very soon.
Cool. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, thank you.
Open up your heart, recall how it used to be, remember all the love we found, ooh,
on Harmony Street, ooh, there was a place that we used to go, when we were feeling down, and we were low. We couldn't believe our eyes when we were there. Wasn't it a big surprise to find we really cared? We looked into each other's hearts. Yes, there were times when we had it all figured out. Then there were times when we both had our doubts. But through it all, you know, our love was complete. We spent all our time on Harmony Street. We couldn't believe our eyes when we were there. Wasn't it a big surprise to find we really cared? We looked into each other's eyes. Street. Yes, There were times when we had it all figured out. Then there were times when we both had our doubts. But through it all, you know, our love was complete. We spent all our time on Harmony Street.
Open up your heart, recall how